This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitz. It's so good to be with you. My guest today is the acclaimed author of literary nonfiction, Melissa Faye Green. Her new book is The Underdogs, Children, Dogs, and the Power of Unconditional Love. Melissa, welcome.
Thank you, Lois. Happy to be here.
Oh, great to have you here. This book began life as a New York Times Magazine feature article. What led you to write the article?
Like most authors, I get asked a lot for publication advice by folks, people I know, people I don't know, a lot of lawyers, especially. My husband's a lawyer, and lawyers all plan to be the next Scott Turow. So a request came in one day, an email from a woman named Donnie Winokur. I didn't know her. She knew my books. Wants publication advice. And I thought, here we go. But I clicked on her website and I thought, this woman has been through hell. I'm going to meet her for coffee. So we met for coffee and she told me a remarkable story. As we started talking, she was taking notes because I was telling her about getting published. But then I said, give me a piece of paper. And I started taking notes on her story. And then I said, Donnie, would you want me to write about this? Mm-hmm. And she did, because she wanted to get her story out. That story was that she and her husband had faced infertility in their 40s and adopted two children from Russia, a little girl and a little boy. The little girl is great. The son, Ayal, was troubled from the very first, raging, just throwing monstrous tantrums triggered by odd things, like if his mother forgot to take a sticker off his banana, or if he would accuse his mother of touching his food, he said he could smell her on it. You know, just really crazy things. In the car one day, there was a napkin on the floor of the back seat, and he tried to open the door and jump out. So what's going on with this child? They went from specialist to specialist, racking up all kinds of diagnoses until when Ayal was four, they got really an earth-shattering diagnosis, which was fetal alcohol syndrome. His mother, his birth mother, had taken in alcohol while pregnant. So this is severe brain damage. The family went into lockdown and isolation and depression. But then Donnie, always searching for answers and for help, found a little service dog agency in Ohio, Four Paws for Ability, that unlike any other agency in the country, was placing dogs with children. And so she called them and described her son. And Karen Shirk, the founder, said, well, I've never heard of fetal alcohol, but this doesn't sound so different from our other kids. And Donnie said, You're going to give us a dog? She was in shock because every door had closed to them. Everyone had said no. And Karen said, I think we can do this. And it was the beginning of a revolution in the life of this family. Within the year, they had brought home a dog trained in Xenia, Ohio by Four Paws, a big, big, handsome, goofy golden retriever named Chancer. And their lives started to stabilize.
Well, essentially, The Underdogs is a portrait of the organization Four Paws for Ability. And I was hoping you could give our listeners a picture of what one encounters on first visit to that Four Paws for Ability setting.
So it was, they renovated the old VFW hall in Xenia, Ohio, and you walk first into just a wall of odor, of the smell of dog. It's you can just about touch it with your hands. You just have to push through and enter this odor of dogs. But unlike animal shelters with their cacophony of miserable, homesick animals squealing and barking and, you know, just the terrible sounds, Four Paws doesn't sound like that at all, because all the dogs here are beloved and busy. And the place kind of hums like an enriched kindergarten. And here are small groups, you know, small circles of dogs working on something. And here's another group that has just gone out for a field trip and they're coming back in refreshed. And there's lots of one-on-one work. It's an amazing thing. For Ayal, every dog there, far above the industry standard, gets 500 hours of training, including 100 hours for a specific child. So, for example, when Four Paws accepted the Winokur family, one of the things they said was, we need to see video of your son. We want 100 hours of video. We want to see everything, every tantrum, what he sounds like, what he looks like, what triggers him. And they trained this big dog Chancer just for Ayal. So, for example, when the Whitakers returned home with Chancer and Eyal started to rage, the parents said, "Disrupt," to Chancer. The way Eyal rages is he would cross his arms, sit down hard, and start banging his feet and banging his head, and just he could scream for hours. Now, with Chancer, the mom would say, "Disrupt," and Chancer gallops over, pushes his nose between Eyal's arms from underneath and unlocks Eyal's arms and snuggles up to Eyal's face and starts licking and licking and licking and turns the tantrum to laughter. Very soon after bringing Chancer home, they discovered that they didn't need to say "disrupt," that at the first scream from Eyal, Chancer would be running through the house to find him and he would disrupt on his own. Sometimes disruption included getting on top of Eyal, because the dog was bigger initially, and just pinning Eyal and sheltering him from the world, kind of with deep muscle, deep pressure massage. Mm-hmm. The third stage with Chancer has been that he disrupts events before they even start. Chancer knows Eyal is going to lose it before anyone else knows, maybe even before Eyal knows, and Chancer intervenes and shelters Eyal. So that's just one example of 1,000 dogs.
It is mind-boggling. And yet, as you write and have obviously researched extensively, scientists have resisted dogs as research subjects and still snub dogs as research subjects, although toward the end of the 20th century, it seemed things were getting better. I was fascinated to read that this actually goes back as far as ancient Greece, that, you know, it's just anecdotal.
One of the most, probably the most amazing thing I learned in the research was that most 20th century scientists did not consider animals capable of thinking or feeling. And for animal lovers, that seems so, it's so self-evident that they have their own personalities and their own tastes and they think and feel. And Darwin certainly believed that and saw individuality in animals and saw intelligence in dogs. But the 20th century scientists were more influenced by Descartes, who famously said, "I think, therefore I am," but he was specifically referring to humans and specifically excluding every other kind of non-human animal, that they don't think. And then behaviorism in the 20th century, which studied conditioning, believed animals to be the unconscious products of conditioning, that they simply reacted automatically. That began to change toward the end of the 20th century, and all kinds of animals began to be welcomed into the big tent of creatures who think and feel. Gorillas, of course, and chimpanzees, and octopuses.
Oh, no! Octopuses. I'm reading about the octopus.
Oh, my God, I fell in love with the octopuses. Oh. They don't have a central brain. Their neural tissue spreads out along all of their tentacles. But they're really smart, and they solve puzzles, and they're curious, and they recognize different humans when they're in aquariums. And they learn from watching one another. And then, you know, fabulous research starting with E.O. Wilson about the kinds of societies that insects create. And some of the discoveries are even that insects have different personalities, not from species to species, but within the identical species, within a certain species of ant. Some are risk takers, some are more the stay-at-home type, some are more altruistic. Amazing stuff. But not dogs. It was not dignified to research dogs, because dogs were seen more as commodities. They were seen as something man-made. Hadn't they been invented in Victorian England when they came up with all of the ridiculous, the prissy breeds and the smushy-faced breeds, and, you know, they weren't a real thing. So for scientists, as field biologists strapped on their boots and their backpacks and headed out for years into rainforests or mountains or glaciers, anyone studying dogs, what was that person going to do, stand behind the living room curtains? You just couldn't be a research subject. But toward the very end of the 20th century, as you said, that started to change. It changed simultaneously at a university in Hungary and at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. The revolution began in part here. There was a professor studying chimpanzees and the human gesture of pointing, the fact that human babies understand pointing as young as 9 months. Before there's language in common, you can point at a bird out the window and the baby sees, or the baby will point to a balloon, implying I want the balloon, you understand. Can chimpanzees do it? So the psychology lab at Emory was working with Yerkes, working with the chimpanzees, and devised an experiment. Here's a treat. We're going to hide a treat under one of two containers, present the two containers to a subject chimp, and then the researcher will point to the correct chimpanzee to relay, your treat is here. It meant nothing to the chimpanzees. They never responded with better than chance. That the pointing didn't mean anything to them in that context. When a young undergraduate in the lab named Brian Hare said, I think my dog can do that. And the professor said, oh, right, everyone's dog can do calculus. But Brian Hare's dog could do it. And they brought Brian's dog, Oreo, into the lab, pointed to the container. The dog went right to it. And they brought in more dogs, and all the dogs understood pointing. And that, my dogs don't. We've tried all these experiments at home.
Hey, I've got a golden observer. He refuses to retrieve.
Right.
He's got human retrievers.
Right, I know. So my dogs don't understand pointing. This research was so much fun because I read about all these amazing experiments. My dogs are just rolling their eyes and taking a nap. I think that my dogs don't have high enough SAT scores to make it to Emory and these big universities. At any rate, the pointing experiment, that dogs could do it, began a whole, it was a mini revolution in cognitive studies, and dogs became subjects of interest and a respectful subject for research, and now they are the rage all over the world.
Oh, the stories are amazing. Early in the book, you describe what has come to be known as the Lassie myth. What is the legacy of the Lassie myth?
Lassie rescued Timmy. No, I forget the number. I have the exact number in the book. I don't know, 912 times, whatever. Although, not from a well. I don't know why. It's so funny
it's
how
one
that
of those
entered.
Urban myths.
It is. But it entered popular culture. Timmy's in the well. Timmy never fell into a well. But Timmy got trapped between two train cars, and he got chased by an escaped circus elephant, and he got chased by an escaped circus ostrich, and he overheard two robbers planning to rob the dairy. Many, many adventures, not a well. And Lassie rescued him. So our generation grew up watching Lassie.
Sunday, 6:30 p.m. Yeah. I was glued.
And then I think our children and our future grandchildren grow up watching it too because it's so popular in reruns. Such a wonderful dog. But people working with dogs, including Karen Shirk and the trainers at Four Paws, warn their clients against the Lassie myth, the faith that, you know, like Mary Poppins, a furry nanny is going to gallop into your house and set everything straight. And they don't want the clients engaging in that kind of magical thinking, mostly because when the parents leave with the dog, the training is ongoing at home, and the parents still have to remain very active and pay attention to the training. Nevertheless, what Karen Shirk doesn't tell parents while warning them against the Lassie myth is that one of her dogs saved her life, essentially answered the phone and barked into it until help came. So,
but take that, Lassie.
I know. She doesn't want people to have these magical thoughts. The head trainer also has a dog who's like Lassie to him. And in fact, the families bring these dogs home, and what they do seems just short of miraculous and worthy of Lassie's consideration. And at the very end of the book, I mentioned that researchers now are sort of looking back at it, not to say that Lassie would have stopped a robbery at the dairy, but that some of the things Lassie did in those scenes were no longer beyond possibility.
We're going to hear about some of those extraordinary things in a moment. Our guest today, Melissa Faye Green, her new book is The Underdogs. This is City Lights on WABE. $5 is a good dog too. Singing he'll do, he'll have the dog in you. Old Bill coming for my own. Old Bill coming for my own. A Bill coming running through the hell of a car. A Bill coming running for my own. We have so much to talk about in terms of Melissa Fay Green's new book, The Underdogs, but if we could take a moment to get personal here. Melissa's daughter, Molly Samuel, is one of WABE's reporters. We are so proud to have her and her marvelous writing. Can't imagine where she came by that. As I was reading, I was thinking, okay, do we mention Molly? Do we not mention, is this a professional? But you mentioned Molly, and I hope that you don't mind sharing the story about how you tried to con that kid into eating chicken.
Molly, like many children, which I mentioned in the book, the approach of children to animals is much more like probably the approach of human ancestors,
yes.
Looking at animals with respect, with fear, with deference, with, you know, curiosity, but certainly not looking at animals in the modern 21st century human way of how fast can we eat them, how fast can we kill them, you know, how fast can we stuff them and put their heads on our office. Well, you know, not, but children aren't like that. Children respect animals. And Molly, as a little girl, was worried about chicken when she realized that chicken, you mean, like she didn't realize that what was on her plate was related to the cute little animals that you see.
It doesn't look
like it. She's, you mean, wait, what? Did they kill the chicken? And I said, no, I think they just waited for the chicken to die, I'm pretty sure. And so then she's trying to sort this out. And obviously thought that was a really weird approach to poultry and said, you mean like, someone just follows a chicken around all day waiting for her to drop dead?
And I said, investigative reporter.
I know. So she didn't buy it and has not eaten meat ever since.
All right. Yeah. Well, we're not condoning one way or the other. You know, there are carnivores, there are vegans, all is well. But something that is just amazing about this book is the testament to the dog human relationship and the ability to overcome adversity because of this relationship. Karen Shirk, the founder of Four Paws for Ability, has a story that is almost unbelievable.
The driving force within the book, I would say, is loneliness and the fact that an interspecies friendship, meaning one between a human and a dog, is as viable and true and enriching a friendship. And for some people who have grown terribly isolated, that friendship can be a way back to life and a way into the world. And so it proves to be for basically all the children I write about in this book. There's a number of different kids who, due to calamity or genetic syndrome or an accident of birth or whatever has happened to the child, has ended up in profound isolation, doesn't know how to make friends, has no friends. And then a dog enters the picture, and it turns out that a profoundly isolated child who's rejecting everyone who tries to get near will kind of open the door a crack if the person who shows up as a dog. Karen was an undergraduate student at Wright State University when she collapsed one day on campus, couldn't move, was almost unable to breathe, was rushed to a hospital, got diagnosed with a rare neuromuscular genetic disease that has onset in the 20s, and almost overnight turned into a long-term disability patient, and with no end in sight. 5 years into her stay at this long-term facility, she had become absolutely just a listless, bloated, depressed, social isolate. A new nurse came and said, well, have you ever thought about getting a service dog? Because the nurse had seen dogs spark patients back to life. Karen was hooked to a ventilator and has to close a hole in her throat to speak. And she said, what could I do with a dog? I can't even take care of myself. The nurse said, yeah, you could take care of a dog. And the nurse helped Karen write letters to service dog agencies all over America, over a period of a year and a half, every single agency rejected her. They literally said, you are too disabled to get one of our dogs. One of them said, we don't place dogs with people unlikely ever to live a productive life. I mean, just terrible stuff. One group finally put her on a waiting list and then visited in preparation for placing a dog, saw her, left, and instead of bringing a dog, sent a letter, you are too disabled. So she started stockpiling morphine. She was in an absolute downward spiral. And the nurse said, Karen, get your own damn dog. And Karen said, how could I get a dog? And she said, Karen, you know, let's get you up. And helped her get up and into a motorized wheelchair, got her into a wheelchair accessible van, and they started looking at puppies. Finally, they came home with a little black German Shepherd puppy. They hired trainers for it. And then Karen had Ben, this magnificently beautiful animal who was ultimately a certified service dog. He helped Karen start walking a few steps, and he forced Karen back into the world, the same way that PTSD service dogs help military vets get back into the world, because the dog has to be walked. It doesn't matter if you want to stay home or stay in bed. The dog has to go to the bathroom. And at one point, Karen just was overwhelmed by the needs of the puppy and said to the nurse, I just got back in. Can you please? And the nurse was like, nope. And so Karen had to move these long unused muscles and get the dog back outside. Within a year, Karen was able to come off the ventilator for much of the day due to new medications. And she and Ben were then, they moved out of the facility and they got their own house. And Karen had this thought, I'm going to start a service dog agency that doesn't tell anyone you are too disabled for a dog. And that's what she did. And that was the start of Four Paws for Ability.
Now, at the core of Four Paws philosophy is that the whole thing is a partnership. And the humans are rescued by the dogs, but in many cases, the dogs themselves have been rescued from shelter. I wish there was time to talk about each story, Melissa. One has to read the book for that. You just have to read the whole book. But which would you highlight now or summarize, if you could, each of the stories? I know there were so many points in the book where I thought, okay, it's not going to get any more heartbreaking / life-affirming than this. but then I'd read another chapter, and it would, I guess, Connor and Casey and Eddie, the trainer and prison dogs, stand out perhaps most of all.
Eddie's a remarkable story. Eddie Hill was a young man in his 20s living in Columbus, Ohio. In high school, he had run with kind of the roughnecks, really a bad crowd. He wasn't a bad guy. He was just sort of a humble, not very self-confident guy. And he fell within the circle of a guy named Duke. And he thought Duke was really cool, and Duke let him hang around. So he got in all kinds of trouble in high school, and now he was in his 20s, kind of drifting, and fell back into Duke's orbit. Duke took him for a joyride one day into the country. They loaded up with vodka. They were playing garage rock on the radio, and Duke was driving faster and faster and faster. Duke had a gun in his glove compartment because he sort of fancied himself to be a big-time drug dealer. At one point, he pulled over and got out and just started shooting at trees in the back in the distance. He was drunk, you know. Then he had, I'm trying to think if Eddie, I guess Eddie was driving, and Duke was like, faster, faster, faster. They zoomed around a curve and hit a truck. Got out to apologize. Eddie got out to apologize. Duke got out drunk with the gun and shot this absolute innocent man in the head and killed him. Another driver came along to help, and he killed him too. So Eddie was convicted as an accomplice, and he's serving a life sentence in the Warren Correctional Agency in Ohio. Four Paws for Ability trains dogs there and starts taking puppies there to hand-selected prisoners. And Eddie Hill turns out to be one of the most gifted dog trainers anyone has ever known. And he has trained hundreds and hundreds of dogs for children with every kind of disability. And now there's a whole movement within the Four Paws family to try to get Eddie Hill out. Four Paws wants to hire him, and there's petitions to the governor. So here's a young man. He was going nowhere, and now he's absolutely gifted with dogs because he was a throwaway. These are shelter dogs he's training, and he gets that they've been thrown away too, and together they bring each other back.
So we must wrap up, but I cannot tell you how astonishing The Underdogs, Melissa Faye Green's new book, and you will be reading at the Marcus JCC this evening. Melissa Faye Green at the Marcus JCC in Dunwoody. That's this evening at 7:30. Book signing and question and answer period. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lois. It was a pleasure.